How did that all start for you, with that radio show in particular?
Basic Black. What happened was I was working in Thunder Bay doing Radio Noon. It was a CBC satellite, which was nice because we didn't have to do much with head office. We hardly ever heard from them. Somebody from Toronto phoned us up and they said, that guy on the Radio Noon show, how would he like to host a poetry show, a national poetry show? And I thought, I don't know. So let's try it. So we did. We lined up a bunch of poets across the country and recorded them. And the CBC brass listened to it and said, hate the show. Don't mind the host. What else would he like to do?
Oh.
And they actually asked me what kind of a show I'd like to do. And I said, well, I'd been doing radio for a while, and whatever celebrities passed through Thunder Bay, I got to interview them. And I was really sick of celebrities because they have a microphone personality. They turn it on and turn it off. So I said, well, if I had a show, I would want to talk to ordinary people with extraordinary stories.
Hmm.
And they mulled that over for a while. And I said, okay, that might work. What do you want to call it? And I just put out a book called Basic Black. So I said, how about Basic Black? He said, no, absolutely not. No. Can't have any names. We don't want personality cults growing on. We had Gabbro, and it was just a problem all the time. So we don't want any more names. I'm sure there can be names like Morningside, Daybreaker, but no names. So I said, oh, all right, sorry. What do you want to call it? They said, Basic Black doesn't sound bad. So that's how we got that. I got the last personality cult show on CBC, I guess.
Yeah, that's about it, I think. They're calling them anything but.
Anything but.
Now.
Yeah, there's them. That's the next one. Anything but.
Well, hi, Arthur.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Nice to come to your home, and you're here on the ocean.
Yes. Overlooking the Pacific Ocean right now, or a small part of it anyway.
Yeah, well, I can see why you wanted to come to Salt Spring if this is what your destination was.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because my office actually overlooks exactly where you're looking now on the ocean, and I kind of have to wear a peak cap or something and hunch over my computer because otherwise I just end up daydreaming the blinders.
The blinders on the horse.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And how long have you and Lynn lived here on Salt Spring?
13 years.
Yeah, well, the house is definitely established. There's that feeling of we're settled here and we're not going anywhere.
Yeah, well, Lynn's the decorator. She's the one that chooses pretty much everything that goes in here. But I love her taste, so that's good for me.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely comfortable.
Good.
I was trying to remember, I know you did 19 years on Basic Black on CBC, and I remember your last show.
Yeah.
Wow. Yes,
yeah.
I listened to it for many, many of those years. I'm trying to remember when that last year was, though.
It was 2002.
Okay.
I'm hesitating a bit because the last show was actually pre-recorded. We were in Thunder Bay,
and
it played about 3 months after we recorded it. So.
Oh, that's what happened. Yeah,
yeah,
because I saw a friend of yours recently, Ken Ham.
Oh, yeah, good old Ken. Yeah,
yeah,
up in Cedar. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
And he told me that he'd been part of that last
show.
That's
right. Yeah.
He was very honored by that.
He's a great guy. We were honored. He's wonderful. I love Ken.
Now you know that he's moved, by the way.
I didn't know. He's not in Cedar anymore.
Oh, man, they moved. I moved to where he was living.
Oh, really?
Near the airport there, near Cedar,
uh-huh.
After Lynn died. You knew that Lynn died?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the last I heard.
Yeah, well, he got together with Heather, who was living in the house I'm now living in. They got married.
Wow.
And they've bought land and a house in Saskatchewan.
In Saskatchewan. Now, Ken went from Thunder Bay to Cedar to Saskatchewan.
He was on Salt Spring, too.
Not permanently.
Briefly, maybe.
Yeah, maybe quite briefly,
okay.
I think. Yeah,
yeah.
And he was also on a fish boat, and he also planted trees, so he gets around.
Yeah. So do you know each other from Thunder Bay?
From Thunder Bay, yeah. He used to work in
a
bookstore in Thunder Bay. That's where I met him, and he was one of the great characters of Thunder Bay.
Yeah. I first saw him in Thunder Bay on my way out west 30 years ago.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah. How did you actually get into radio in the first place? Was this a childhood dream, or how did it happen?
Actually, I got fired from Imperial Oil. I was working at Imperial Oil on their magazine. It was called the Imperial Oil Review, which was kind of a vanity magazine. They hired top drawer authors like Farley Moe to write stories for them, and it was all a feel-good magazine. It was basically made to make Imperial Oil not look like the corporate ravening monster it is.
Okay.
So they were acutely sensitive to any kind of controversy. And it almost ruined me as a writer forever because you would write a story, and if you mentioned a loaf of bread in your story, then it had to go through the commercial foodstuffs department. It took literally 8 months for anything you wrote to see print, and it bore no resemblance to what you wrote in the first place. So I started writing things anticipating who they would piss off, basically. And so I started writing tentatively, all the way along. And pretty soon, you're not writing at all.
No.
It was awful. I did that for about a year and a half. And one day, for who knows what reason, I went in and asked for a raise. This was a huge blunder because nobody even realized I was there before. And they looked at my work record and they said, actually, no raise. And in fact, you're out of here. So they fired me. And I had two job choices. I could replace telephones for Bell Telephone at $1 a unit, or I thought I'd go to CBC and see if they had anything at all, because I had taken radio and television arts in Ryerson years before. Hmm. And I went in and they said, well, there is an opening for an agriculture reporter. Have you any experience? The experience I had at that point was in lying. And I said I had extensive experience in agriculture because I'd written a story about the North Saskatchewan River for the Imperial Review, which never saw print. Anyway, I lied my way into the job and it worked. I became an agriculture reporter. Then I went on to become an environmental reporter. Then I got fired again. No, I didn't get fired. I got relocated to Thunder Bay for 13 years.
Whoa.
And I ended up being a radio host in Thunder Bay. And then, as I said before, I got into Basic Black. And then it got easy.
Yeah, then you just went on a roll.
Yeah, it was nice.
Was the setup for Basic Black your own? Like, did you format that show yourself?
Beyond saying that I didn't want to talk to famous people, no. Basic Black, everybody said, I don't know how you find all those people. Well, I didn't find all those. We had three producers who worked really hard, and they did all the hard work. And in fact, they produced the script each week, and I would edit it to my, put it in my words, but they did 99% of the work, and I was just the sex object.
You were the front man.
Yeah.
All right, so you were a writer to start with.
Yeah.
That was where you started. So your columns that you do now, were you doing them at the same time as Basic Black? Because those closing commentaries with each show, a lot of those, of course, are in your books.
Yeah.
I mean, I recognize some of them. I remember them. I can hear your voice when I read them. Yeah. Did you write them first and then put them on, or did they...
Well, it's a funny thing. I love writing for radio because radio is like somebody telling you stories all night.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like the bedtime stories.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful and a privileged thing to do. But I also realized after I'd been in radio for 5 or 6 years that I was becoming what I call post-literate. I was forgetting how to write for the eye. I was writing for the ear, which is fine.
Yeah.
But when I wrote to my Aunt Beulah, I would write with dots, you know, which meant that you pause. And if I wanted to emphasize something, I'd put it in capital letters. And that looks weird on the page. So I had a little bit of a panic. I thought, I'm forgetting how to write for the eye. At the same time, I was approached by a local newspaper to do a weekly column. They said, we just want to run your monologues. I said, no, I'll write something for the newspaper.
Okay, yeah.
Because I knew it was different. It doesn't work the same. So that's how I started writing one column a week for the eye and one column a week for the ear.
Oh, yeah.
And other stuff in between.
Yeah. Now, on your website, which I should mention is basicblack.com.
Which I neglect shamefully, I might add.
So is it still current that you are having no scheduled appearances right now?
No, see, that's it. I didn't know that was on there.
Yeah, it says no appearances at this time or something.
Oh, is that right? Oh, yeah. It makes me sound like I'm a recluse or I've got TV or something.
Well, yeah, like you're having to regroup.
No,
or
you know
something.
What it is, I have to figure out how to enter what I'm doing. So it's easier just to say, I'm not doing anything. I have no idea how to access my own thing. I can get the mail off it. That's it. I had somebody who set it up for me, and then they just said, okay, you're on your own.
Yeah. Maybe we can segue just a little bit from that to the fact that you're not too computer literate, you admitted to
me. That's the nicest way it's ever been put. I'm a computer idiot what I am. And I'm computer hostile, too, which is not helpful.
And hostile,
helpful.
Even. Yeah. I used to feel like that. I can relate to how you feel. I mean, it's only 2 years since I got my own computer.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding. And I'm like almost 51. For many years, I resisted very strongly, and I just thought that some of us have to stay unplugged, or who's going to know the difference,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I can really relate to it. I must say that my world has opened up incredibly since I surrendered, gave up the resistance. It sounds like you're gradually getting...
I know you're in the promised land, and I'm not, and I know that now. Like, I wouldn't have said that even a year ago. I would have said you're a heretic, and you're going to burn in hell. But I know now that you have the truth and the light on your side, and I don't. And I'm working my way painfully, inch by inch, over to your position.
Yeah, well, and gradually, of course, I know I'm justifying it to myself. If I go for a day without the computer on, it's like, oh my God, I remembered life like this. It went on for days, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I went to Hawaii for 10 days, and I had withdrawal symptoms. And finally, at about day six, I broke down and went to a cafe and got somebody to tell me how to find my mail. And I had like 360 messages, emails. And I spent the rest of the day and about $26 to check these mails. Nothing was important.
Yeah.
But except my peace of mind, you know, so... But it was a waste of time.
It is a real space filler, a time waster.
It will eat your life. Unfortunately, it's also really handy. I can't imagine going back to a typewriter. I spent most of my formative years in writing, pecking away at a typewriter, and loved the idea, but I'd never go back to it. It would be like going back to a quill pen.
Mm-hmm. So you do all your writing
all
by the
computer?
Computer?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I like writing by hand still, but I can organize my thoughts way better on a Word document.
Absolutely, yeah. I like writing by hand too. The only problem is I can't read it anymore. You know, I'm worse than my doctor. My handwriting is just really degenerated. So the computer's just so doggone neat. Although that's the trap too, because everything looks so good that you actually miss a lot of really, really dumb mistakes. You know, like, oh, that looks neat and clean. I'll have that published.
It must be official because it's all printed, right?
Yeah. There's no hand scratches on it.
One of the features that you had on Basic Black, I hope you don't mind talking about Basic Black, is the hum line with Danny Marks, and Sheila Rogers was on that too, eh?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I just saw a mention of that somewhere. I knew that Danny Marks was because I knew I'd heard him somewhere before.
Human Jukebox. He's amazing. He used to make a living going to bars. I mean, he's tired of bars. It makes him, make him sound like a drunk. He'd go there and he'd say, you name a tune or hum a bar of it and I will play it for you. And he could do that. From the 50s, 60s, 70s, he was...
Yeah, I saw him at Jeff Healy's actually last year. Yeah, before Jeff had to start taking off. And now he's passed, which is still hard to absorb. When I saw him there, I went, wait a second, I know his voice. And I was hearing him on Jazz FM a little bit. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, yeah, the hum line. Yeah, like, I just put it together.
He was the meat and potatoes of the hum line because he was the guy
for
who knew the music. And he was the guy who had to... The hum line, it can be told here for the first time, was a little bit of a fraud.
Oh, was it?
Well, yeah.
It up, didn't you?
Well, sure. I mean, when you think about it, how else could you do it? Because we got like 400 calls a week from people who say, yeah, I know a song that's got the banker on the dry, and it sounds a bit like this, and then we'd have to try and find that. So you get it down to about four songs that would actually work. And then somebody had to play them. We had to sing them and play them. Somebody had to put it together.
Sure.
And that was Danny. You know?
Yeah.
So he would figure out the guitar chords and the music for it. He often knew it off the top of his head, but as often he didn't. You know, and we'd have to look it up. It always was contrived to sound spontaneous.
Yeah.
Which,
such as radio.
Yeah. That's it.
The trick is to keep it sounding spontaneous.
Radio's always like that. I mean, who could guess listening to us that we're both naked right now?
That is the ongoing joke with radio, for sure. Just jumping topics a bit, besides darts, any other games you like to play?
No, I'm not a game
player. Not a game player.
I don't like cards. I get really depressed when I go down a ferry and I see people playing cards, like couples. I don't know why, but it's like waiting for Godot or something for me. It looks really unhealthy. And it's not, but it is to me. Crossword puzzles, but that's a solitary.
That's a solitary thing.
The fact that I'm clumsy probably has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, if you lose all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
It's a little fun.
Of course you don't like it.
I don't think I was ever much of a games player.
So are you competitive?
I'm very fussy about words, and that's about it. About nothing else in life am I fussy, I don't think.
So you're a perfectionist when it comes to words.
Agnegal and I'm pedantic, I'm told that by certain parties who shall not be named. I'm told that I'm quite pedantic about words.
Pedantic. That's a word.
That's a word. That's a good word, yeah.
You're not only a wordsmith, but you're apparently a doctor of words. How did this happen?
Oh, that was Lakehead University in Thunder Bay decided to give me an honorary doctorate. I think they thought that if they gave me an honorary doctorate, I would contribute money to them every year, which was a huge mistake because I didn't. But I've been an honorary doctor, I guess, for about, I don't know, 15 years, and it's made absolutely no difference in my life at all. None. When I go to a flight, I keep meaning to say, I'm Dr. Black, and hoping it'll upgrade me into first class, but I always forget that I'm a doctor, so I've never done it yet. It's never made one iota of difference in my life. Sorry, Lakehead, but...
I'm very particular about being called Miss. I don't like being called Ms.
Yeah.
There was no distinction for Miss, so I chose Honorable, hoping that someone would pick up on that, but they didn't.
That's even better. Try Honorable Doctor. That might work.
Yeah. So do you travel a lot?
I have in the past. The last few years of Basic Black, there was a lot of travel. Travel's not fun anymore.
Yeah.
Being in places is still interesting, but getting there is not much fun. I find airports and the whole travel experience is pretty hideous now. So I'm not traveling that much now. I do speaking engagements every once in a while. And...
Oh, well, that brings us back to your website.
Oh, no. What does it say now?
Well, the fact that you aren't speaking anywhere right now.
Yeah, see, this could be why the invitations have dried up.
If it looks like you're just saying the door is closed, do not disturb, what are we supposed to do?
Well, the thing is, I don't really mind if I don't get asked. When somebody says, oh, would you like to speak in Arizona? Well, half of me goes, and the other half goes, oh, geez.
Oh, man.
You know, do I have to go to the airport again?
Yeah, and I like my home. And
yeah, I don't.
Why would you leave?
I don't much like leaving. Yeah. But as far as I get is the place I met you at Yellow Point Lodge, and it's what, about half an hour up the road?
It's really close to both of us. I know it's funny that that's where we met.
Yeah.
But that was meant to be. It was a surprise I was even going to be there, so it was a bonus. The other thing on your website, it says currently underpaid for ... So do you make a living doing what you're doing?
I seem to, yeah. It's interesting. Yeah, between, I've got a newspaper column, I've got a magazine column in Carp, which has changed its name to Zoomer, by the way. I just read.
Really?
Yeah. Every 2 weeks I do something on CBC in Victoria, which is nice. It keeps my hand on the radio. And other little things come up, book reviews and interviews and stuff I do along the way. And it seems to work.
It all adds up.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
I shop in thrift shops. That's where my wardrobe comes from. So I don't have expensive tastes in a 5-year-old car and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, come on. We're only here temporarily.
You know? I see people buying like $80 T-shirts because it's got Tommy Hilfiger's name on it.
Yeah.
Tommy should give me $80 if I'm going to wear his T-shirt. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a wealthy artist I met in Hawaii one time who said that he doesn't get a fancy car. He doesn't want to stand out.
That's right. Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that makes a lot of sense. I'll keep that in mind for when my time comes.
Yeah.
You've got books, and I only have 4 of them sitting here, full of these nice little monologues that you do. There's a certain length to them. How many words is that?
It's 2.5 pages, double-spaced.
Okay.
Or 2 minutes and 45 seconds to 3 minutes long to be read. I read like a machine gun, so it's faster than most.
You clip along.
Yeah, that's the length. I can't even tell you how many words I don't
know. No, you don't know, eh? Oh,
no,
okay.
But I know what it looks like on a computer.
Yes, exactly. Well, there's a little word count that you can press.
Yeah, I know. I must do that sometime and find out how many words I'm doing.
Yeah. No, I was just curious because there's definitely, you know, I don't want to say formula, but...
That seems to be my thought bubble. I've tried to write things longer than that, and I have occasionally, but... It's not a comfortable genre for me, so that seems to be what I was
interesting,
doing.
Because when I put together my show Living on Purpose, I wanted to do something like that. I wanted to have some kind of, you know, send-off, final thoughts, and I finally called it The Inspiring Moment, which I carried on with, and that various things happened in that. It wasn't always, you know, a monologue. Definitely your show was one of the things. There was a few shows on CBC over the years that I kind of modeled my show on a bit.
Right, yeah.
Like yours, Stuart McLean's, Sheila Rogers a little bit. Well, Peter Zosky.
Yeah,
I mean, before Sheila, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and Finkelman's 45.
Yes, yes. There's another one that would almost disappear. Because of CBC's ham-handedness, it was only on for about 2 years, but it was called Parka Patrol.
Oh.
Gary Dunford out of Toronto. It was funny. It would have been a classic if CBC had not
let it die. Oh, too
bad. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you miss CBC?
No. No. I miss some of the people. I miss some of the laughs.
Yeah,
but,
and you learned a lot. I mean,
stretch. It was a wonderful job. I loved it, but I did it for... I actually did CBC for 30 years. So,
wow.
And that's enough.
And
it's also... There's a time, you know, there's an arc, and I reached the end of mine. I remember there was one day when I realized that I was reading a comic strip in the cafeteria. It was Dagwood. And it was blah, 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 Faith Hill. And I said, who's Faith Hill? And everybody who were like all 15 years younger than I am.
Yeah.
They all kind of coughed and looked away.
You know, like,
they all knew who. And I thought, I'm out of my element.
I'm out of here.
Yeah. I come from another time. When I was growing up, Roy Rogers wasn't a restaurant.
You know, right.
Tim Hortons played hockey.
Yeah.
So there comes a time when you suddenly realize you're not terribly relevant to a big part of the population. So.
Speaking of being a little older, not old, but older. You were born in 1943, which makes you around retirement age, as the official ways go. What do you feel about retirement? What does it mean to you?
I retired by choice, I thought, when I finished Basic Black in 2002.
Okay.
But there's no such thing as retirement, especially for a writer, I don't think. I'm still writing almost as much as I'm certainly, the only thing I'm not doing as much as I did before is commuting. I'm not traveling, and that's fine with me. I'm still writing every day, enjoying it, hating it as much as I ever did. You know, it's a love-hate thing. But it's a necessary thing. It's just something you do. So, something I do anyway.
And you do that in the morning?
I try to. Yeah. I get up. I'm an early riser. It's funny. You know, every once in a while I get asked to speak at a school. And they always say, you know, what's the secret of success? And I say, I'm going to tell you, and you're going to laugh, and you're going to not do what I said. Okay? You're going to think it's absolutely insane. I said, get up 2 hours earlier than you do now. And it's just a chorus of groans. Oh, God, are you kidding? What, you know, get up at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, right.
I know, I'm talking 5 o'clock.
Yeah, right, 9 o'clock.
Get up at 5 o'clock. And, of course, kids, it's not even thinkable for them, you know, for most of them.
Well, unless they stay up all night.
Yeah, they can arrive there, yeah. But to get up at that time, if there is a secret to my success, that's what it is. I got up early. There's nothing else to do in the morning but work, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't phone anybody. The TV is lousy. You can't make much noise. It's usually too dark to go for a walk. Might as well work. Might as well write. I find 2 hours of work in the morning is worth like 6 hours. I was always amazed because I work part-time at CBC. For the last 20 years, I only work 3 days a week. I do most of my work at home. I'd come in and these guys would come and sit on my desk and tell me, you know, boring stories. I think, no, I haven't got too much time here. I'm here to work. I wasn't trying to be a dork about it, but I really knew my time was limited. Because they worked 40-hour weeks at the office every day, 9 to 5, they had expanded their time, so there was all this flab in it. Like where they came and they sat around the water cooler, they went for coffee, they chatted about television and stuff like that. And to say that anybody works 40 hours a week is a joke. No, they mostly don't.
Well, it's probably part of the reason that they cut back on those hours, right?
Yeah.
Because they thought, hey, we could be having more of a life outside
Absolutely.
Of this environment.
Yeah.
But then you see these sitcoms, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're hanging around chatting, sort of having fun with each other.
Yeah, I know. They call it work, but it's not work at all. It's socializing, you know, it's socializing with a tie on.
Well, it's like going to school, only somebody's paying you.
That's right. Yeah. If you're lucky.
Yeah. This is Lynn Thompson on Living on Purpose, and I'm in conversation with Arthur Black, and I'm interviewing you, but you've done a lot of interviewing, and I'm curious to know how it is for you being interviewed.
It's hard for me to shut up and say, but enough about me. It's a funny feeling. I really feel like I'm hogging the mic here. You know what I'm saying? I have to stop myself from stopping myself.
Right. Yeah. As you say, on Basic Block, other people were producing it as far as getting the people organized for you to talk to, right? Mm-hmm. So what did you enjoy the most about interviewing those people once they were in front of you?
What I enjoyed was putting them at ease. It's odd because I think a lot of people not in the media don't realize this, or maybe they realize it better than the people in the media do, that the microphone is like a loaded revolver. You can and you point it at people, and you can. I've seen people totally intimidated by the microphone.
Yeah.
You can embarrass them, you can shame them, you can humiliate them, and they won't react to it. Normally, they pop you one, but because that microphone is sitting there, they think you've got a right to do that. And I was, I don't know where I became aware of that, but I became aware that it was. I felt a lot better if the person after I'd finished speaking said, "You know, you really made that easy."
Yeah,
and that's a really good feeling for me. I never was a hard-nosed interviewer. I was more interested in a good time than anything else.
Yeah,
my favorite story was about interviewing was the Italian woman who died last year, Oriana Fallaci. She was a really interesting, feisty woman, and she was about 4'3". And one time she was down at NASA headquarters interviewing the astronauts as they came down from a flight, and she was with all these hard-boiled reporters who were elbowing her aside and putting their elbows over the top of her because she was so short. And Walter Cronkite was moderating and you know, taking in all these technical questions about, yes, well, we had the helium reservation, and all that really impossible. And finally saw this little woman agitating. Yeah, yes, the woman from Italy there. What's your questions? And she looked at the astronauts and she said, "Were you scared?" And they melted. They stumbled and they bumbled and they didn't know how to answer. They didn't have a prepared answer for that. But it's all anybody wanted to know. You know, that was the number one question.
Well, you put yourself in their place, right? And you try to imagine.
Yeah. Oh. But she's the only one who got it in the whole room.
Excellent.
You know? Yeah. So I always try to look for that. I never got that good, but I always wondered if you could find that one question that would connect the listener and the person you're talking to. You know, just like that. Direct line.
Yeah, I don't think I found that question with you yet.
Well, you almost never do. It's like it's the holy grail.
Well, it is. Yeah, it's one of those tricky things. Speaking of our mutual friend Ken Ham, I talked to him briefly this week. I'm going to see him soon in a couple of days. I'm going to see him and Heather, and I told him I was coming to speak with you, and he said, "Well, say hi to him for me." So, hi from Ken.
Good. Yeah.
And also, I asked him, "Well, do you have any inside scoops on him that would help me?"
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And he said, "Well, Arthur is a closet singer and guitar player."
Oh, he flatters me. It's funny. I just got rid of two guitars because I looked at them and they've been sitting in the back of my office and I realized I hadn't picked them up for 2 years. And of course, my fingers are all soft. But to hear Ken Ham call you a guitarist. Ken Ham is the greatest blues guitarist I ever heard.
And
so he was being very nice, but quite wrong.
Oh, well, he obviously thinks highly of you.
Nice guy.
You're mentioned here in these books as being a curmudgeon in one and cantankerous in the other. Would you consider yourself that way?
I think so, yeah.
Because you seem to get pretty cranky about a lot of topics.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of your trademark, is sort of going on a bit of a rant.
Yeah. I sprinkle rants with humor, hopefully.
Oh, yeah,
Like I try to have a change-up pitch.
Well, I think that's what makes it all palatable, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know why that is. It just, I can't do anything else. So I rant.
You've probably given up quite a while ago then, being worried about what other people think?
No, I wouldn't say so.
I'm concerned about...
Yeah, I'm pretty concerned. Yeah, I don't think I'm a Rafe Mayer. I have my own boundaries, you know, like whether I go beyond that.
Yeah, you can sense what that is.
Yeah, and I rant at pretty safe stuff. I rant at things that everybody finds annoying.
Yeah.
You know? The only person I've ever really taken off on in the last few years is Dan Brown, who wrote The Da Vinci Code.
Oh, yes.
Which I think is the worst book I have read, worst popular book I've read in decades. It's painfully bad. I went into a total rant. Well, I'm starting again. Just spontaneously, I wrote a review of the book and sent it into the Times columns, and they ran it. But it scared the hell out of me because it's the most popular book in years. It's sold like 100 million copies.
Well, it's a little concerning how something that is not the greatest piece of writing can become so popular that you're a heretic if you go against that flow, right?
Not only that, I have a clipping somewhere where people have voted it the best book of all time. Now, I don't know what the peer group was here that decided that, but some group somewhere, it's just scary to me that two people, never mind a group, have decided this is the best book that was ever written. And it's terrible. It's awful. It's awful, awful, awful. Like if I was writing and doing an English course, I'd say, don't ever write a book like this. And I could tell you, list the reasons why. It's just, it's just hideous. It's
okay, we can switch moving right along. There's a very heartwarming piece that in one of your books here that I remember you sharing on your show about the woman who found the necklace and returned it to the owner, who gave her a tiny pittance of what it was worth in thanks and drove off. You remember that one?
You know what? I'm drawing a total...
Okay. You started off with the whole thing about saying thanks and what thanks means to you and how flippantly we use it. Mm-hmm. And that's what sort of caught my ear about it, was how there are different levels of gratitude, and you didn't want to diminish the idea of gratitude and being thankful for the really meaningful things. But thank you and thanks are also used at the grocery line when you're heading off, or on the phone, or thanks for that, or a little run off on the email or whatever. This was something that had really touched you at the time, and now you don't remember, of the woman who had shown up in the news, who had found this necklace, and she was in modest circumstances, and she found this beautiful necklace in the parking lot on her way back to her car.
Oh, this is ringing a bell now.
She went in and got it appraised, and it was worth like $250,000, and she spent $50 to put an ad in the paper.
That's right, yeah.
Because it could have totally changed her life, but she was raising her children, to be honest, and wasn't going to be a hypocrite, right?
Well, that's interesting. I've forgotten the specific story, but it's something that occurs again and again. I just wrote something recently about a woman in Toronto. This is a much more modest scale, but she goes to Tim Hortons. She likes to get a coffee and donuts. She pays for the car behind her. She just says, whatever they're having, I pay for it. And so the people roll up and they get their order, and somebody says, it's okay, it's been paid for. It blows them away. What do you mean? Who paid for it? Well, that person driving away over there. I don't know them. It doesn't matter. Somebody at Tim Hortons said, it's interesting because it's a chain reaction. Those people then often do it for the car behind them.
It opens up the mind.
Still pay it forward thing.
Like at a toll booth. Like that's something where you know what the next person's going to have to
pay.
But Tim Hortons, that's pretty nice. Like they just dropped a five or something to.
Yeah, well, I guess the orders come in, and so then.
Then they knew what it was going to be.
So if it's a party of 12, maybe you pass that day.
If you're bringing
the baseball team, you might want to think about that.
That was just recently, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember your very first written piece? Do you remember what it was?
Yep. I started a newspaper when I was, I think, about 6.
Oh.
I started a newspaper, and it was hand-drawn, and it lasted for exactly one issue. The lead story was, there was a drawing by me in pencil of a bird, and it said, I think the headline was, it was an interesting bird found on Mr. Rutherford's lawn, spotted on Mr. Rutherford's lawn. And it was like a sparrow or something.
Yeah, right.
And I think Mr. Rutherford actually bought the one issue.
Aww.
Of the
Since he was featured and all.
Yeah, right. the whole thing was hand-printed. It was called the Something Gazette, I think. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that was the first. I don't remember any of the words I wrote other than the headline. There was a story that went with this hand-drawn picture of a sparrow.
Yeah.
I was very young. I was very, very young. I guess it was kind of prescient because it was my idea of what a newspaper columnist would do.
Yeah. So was that around the time that you had that rocket radio?
It would be around that time, The old rocket radio. Yeah, the one you used to attach to the radiator in your house,
And it had no dial or anything?
No dial. Just... It's this bar that you pulled in and out, and you get...
And total luck of the draw, came through, right?
Yeah, you get CBC, then you get Winning West Virginia.
And what was the other one? Voice of Doom?
Oh, Voice of Doom, Lauren Green?
Yeah.
That's good old Lauren. And Lauren Green was a CBC announcer, which a lot of people don't know. And of course, I guess a lot of people don't know who Lauren Green was now, don't they?
Well, I know, but I'm older too.
Bonanza. Okay, Bonanza. He was Bonanza. Paul Cartwright. And he was also a Shakespearean actor, but he had what they called the voice of doom, and he used to be the CBC announcer. And his voice was so low, it would make your shoelaces untie, you know. But I remember one time he was doing the weather. I mean, I heard about this. I didn't hear it myself on the radio. And he said something about, and the weather in Kapuskasing. It's Kapuskasing. So it's the only mistake he ever made in his entire life, I'm sure. But.
So living around Thunder Bay, that's making me think, you know Kamen Istikwah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure do.
I like impressing people by saying that. Because it was like, how do you know that? Do you know how to spell it, though?
That's right. Kamen Istikwah.
Yeah, right.
Or the Cam, as they call it up there.
The Cam. That's right. The Cam.
Ken Ham and the Cam.
Yeah. How close is that? So you send all your stuff to these newspapers by computer now? You don't use Canada Post at all?
No, did for years and years. Yeah, did for years and years.
So they must miss you.
I think so. I was subsidizing them there for a while.
Yeah.
No, it all goes up by magic now. Computer, one button. Used to be, I have to, Lynn, my partner, would address me, do all the envelopes every week and stamp on every envelope.
Yeah.
And I'd make copies down at local Xerox joint. And that's all. That's the magic of the computer.
That's a bit of history there.
Yeah.
Shall we take a little pause?
Sure.
Okay. Tea's ready. Arthur Black is my guest today on Living on Purpose, and I'm very pleased to be here at the home of him and Lynn here on Salt Spring Island.
This house is actually an old boathouse, so it was pretty bad shape when we bought it. Where we're sitting now was outside, so there was just little tiny windows looking out this way. And as you can see, we can see the ocean now from here. And before, we never looked out here, because we just had these little dinky windows. And you realize that the ocean is like watching a fire. It changes all the time, and it's never less than fascinating, you know. It doesn't matter what it's doing, raining, shining, storming, placid, it's always interesting.
Yeah, well, and like a fire, it draws the gaze.
Absolutely, yeah.
I know, as soon as I walked in, I went, hey, all right, so you don't live on the lake. You didn't tell me you live on the ocean.
it's very nice. We really do love this place. We've lived in a few places, Lynn and I, and this is the place we're supposed to be.
Yeah, I think
really
so. Yeah. Now, you started out in Toronto?
Yeah, I was born in Toronto. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Many, so was
many
I.
Years ago.
Were
you?
Many years ago?
Yeah. Between you and me, I've never liked Toronto. I've never, ever liked it. It's the only city in the world. That's true. I don't know what it is. We never hit it off right from the beginning. Well, I was born in the suburbs, so I was born in Etobicoke, which was, I mean, there were pheasants behind my house when I was born. That wasn't Toronto proper.
My first early memory years, like around kindergarten time, were in Asian Court, sort of the opposite side of
That's
Toronto.
Right. Yeah,
and I remember it just being open farmland, like we lived out on a farm for a little while. And I remember, interesting memory at that age, that my friend and I walked up the backyard to the fence line because we wanted to see what was on the other side of it. And I still remember the disappointment of looking out and it was just more land. Right?
What the heck?
Yeah, what the heck? I don't know what I expected to see. But now, I mean, that house finally got dismantled after being the only remaining heritage house, and now it's gone. And
wow.
There's a little park, a little woods across the street from where we were, I think is still there, but it's all condominiums and shopping mall and everything. Yeah.
It's funny, when I grew up, Toronto was called the City of Trees, but I can't imagine anybody calling it that.
No. Now, you like to go with things that, as you say, lots of people get up in arms about or complain about, like cell phones, for example. Have you done a rant on that?
Several, maybe a few. Many.
Uh-huh.
I still get very depressed when I see people walking down the street with their hand clamped to their ear, you know? And I don't know why. I mean, it's here. It's going to happen. I might as well get used to it, But there's something about it that it's the disconnect, I think. It's the fact that the people are here, but they're not here. You know?
Do you have a cell phone yourself?
You know I do. It's in that drawer over there. It stays in the drawer almost all the time. We bought it because I walked the dogs in some pretty rough terrain. I thought, well, it'd be really stupid if I broke my leg and nobody would find me for ages.
Mm-hmm.
But do I ever carry it? No. So, you know, it was a free cell phone. That's all I could say. Excuse I've got.
Yeah, right. No, but I've noticed that. I know what you mean, because as soon as you are somewhere else holding that, I lose connection with my environment.
Yeah,
if I'm walking, and very rarely when I'm driving, right away, you're not all present.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing is just the total superfluity of it all. Like, I remember the first time it hit me, I was on a plane. We landed in Vancouver. And as soon as we cleared the plane, everybody got on the phone, their cell phones, and said, "Hi, we just landed. Was this call necessary?"
Yeah.
Of course you just landed. What's the alternative? You know,
Yeah, right.
You wouldn't be making this call if you hadn't just landed. And does it matter, you know, that you just landed? But everybody felt compelled, I think, justifying the fact that they were carrying a cell phone to call somebody and tell them that you're...
It's taken away our permission to have time to ourselves.
Yeah. It's another time robber. It's
yeah.
And blackberries or crackberries is their...
No, I'm drawing the line there.
Yeah, me
for
too.
Sure.
Me too.
Oh, yeah.
I never, ever... I think, Lynn, it's going to be a sign of elitism, desirable elitism, not to be connected. This will show that you're important enough.
You're
not
beyond
to be
that.
I like to think that's true. You know, I have people to take my emails, to take my cell phone calls.
Yeah, I'm always a little surprised when people who are well known will take calls.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
interesting.
It's like a virus on its own. You know, it's got to be connected. I see kids now, and of course, cell phones are becoming like the Star Trek phaser thing. I mean, they can do everything now. They need everything but surgery.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's bizarre.
In one of your books, full of 2.5 pages typed pieces of writing, you have one where somebody asks you, "How's your solar system?" Do you remember that one?
Is this about my... Yeah, this is another incarnation, another house I lived in.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we had...
And he asked you that more than once.
It was very bizarre. We lived in a house that we didn't belong in. And it had a solar heating system for the pool. And somebody said to me, "How's your solar system?" And I had that moment of, what? You mean compared to my galaxy?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
it was odd. Yeah, that was not a good house.
Yeah, memorable only on that level. Oh, yeah, I was wondering about influences and mentors. Now, we've mentioned a few of the people like Lauren Green and, you know, some of those early images of radio and stuff. Are there any other mentors that we haven't mentioned?
The best person I ever heard on radio and in the kind of commentaries that I admire is Garrison Keillor from Prairie Home Companion. He's still around. Well, he still does a show called Prairie Home Companion. And when I lived in Thunder Bay, it was done live in Minneapolis. And I didn't appreciate how live it was. It was actually St. Paul, they're Twin Cities. And it's done in a terrible old theater. I forget the name of it. There's paint coming off the walls. We went down to see a show. It's a national show. It's done every week, every Saturday night. And it is truly a live radio show. Like if somebody in the band drops the drumsticks, you hear the drumsticks dropped on the ground. It's live. It's all live. It's an amazing show. It's sort of slightly corny. Like he'd have somebody on doing, you know, Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery commercial, some hokey thing. And then he'd say... And now my special guest, Mahalia Jackson. It would be Mahalia Jackson or Chet Atkins. And there'd be no other fanfare, right? You hear CBC now, coming up, they come on like... There was none of that in this show. It was just a total surprise. Garrison Keillor never said his name on this show. Never said it at beginning, middle, or end. There was no credits. And it was just like a magic piece of audio theater.
Yeah, just being present for it.
Yeah. And this man, this amazing man, Garrison Keillor, he's about 6'5". He's as homely as a fence post. He wears Coke bottle glasses and red socks and a white suit. And he comes up at the end of the show and he says, "Well, it has been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon." And he goes on to spin this tale about this fictional little town in northern Minnesota that's got Lutherans and fishermen and all kinds of incredibly amazing people. He tells this story with no notes and he tells it to time. I didn't realize it until I watched the show live. He's watching a clock on the wall which says, like, in California on Pacific time, you've got 5 seconds left. His stories would be 7 minutes long or 2 minutes long or 13 minutes long, however long they needed to be. And they were seamless. I could not figure out where you would edit or where he would edit or pad anything he said. And he did this every week.
Wow.
And he did it from his head. He lived it, you know. He's the genius. He's the genius of radio. I've never seen anything or anything like him.
That's great.
Still there. If you can get NPR, you can find Prairie Home Companion, and it's
worth
the listen.
Yeah, Prairie Home Companion. Yeah, I've heard of that. I don't recognize his name.
Yeah. Well, he never says it on the show. That's
right. How would you know?
Yeah, I know.
This is Living on Purpose. You don't know who I am, but... Hey, what do you think about them wanting to change it to Salish Sea?
I don't feel bad about that. No,
yeah,
that,
you're open
that,
to that?
That's kind of nice, yeah.
There was a variety of feedback on the open line just on my way here, yeah.
At least as interesting as Gulf of Georgia, and I think more so. You know, like it's always an empire that's memorializing itself, so why not the native people? You know?
Well, some people are upset about having to change names on maps and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but,
I understand that, too, yeah.
I mean, they changed the name of them all in Nanaimo. Surely they, you know, I mean, things can change.
Sacred.
No. And Salish Sea, I mean, I get this whole... Oh, there's a swishbuckling kind of, like there's a pirate on the high seas kind of feeling about it to me.
Oh, I like it. It's got a nice, I'm for it. I'm not for all name changes forever, but that sounds like a good one to me. Well, you know, I lived in Thunder Bay, and it's still called the Lakehead. It was called the,
That's right.
It changed its name in 1952, I think it was. And you still say the Lakehead when you're there.
That's
you
know, right, yeah.
They'll say Thunder Bay, too, but it's they're bilingual up there.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, belly laughs guaranteed or money refunded when you're doing public speaking?
Yeah, well,
have you ever had to do that?
Never had to refund the money yet, no. I've had some interesting times with various groups, but I've never had to refund money.
You do speak to a lot of schools, eh, to kids?
Yeah, I do. Not a lot, but every once in a while. My natural audience are people about my age.
And, yeah.
And kids sort of look at you like you're some kind of a walking freak. You know? They're polite, but they
but you're a bit
sure
of an oddity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of references that they wouldn't get at all.
Is there anything that you would say as a statement for what Living on Purpose means to you, Arthur Block?
I haven't ever thought of it.
I've put you on the spot so we can come back to it if you'd like.
Can I have a week?
Who was that guy from London? Quimby or something?
George St. John Quimby.
Yeah. Dong, dong, dong.
Yeah, George St. John Quimby. He was a character, all right.
Yeah, where did he come from?
He actually did live in London, England, and he did a news bit for us every week on Basic Black for several years. There would be the sound of the Big Ben bonging, and he would say, "This is George St. John Quimby in London." And then he would tell these stories, and they were always bizarre news stories. And he would tell them in what we thought was an impeccably posh English voice, but which English people told us was a terrible, terrible conglomeration of yeah. Liverpool and Cockney and several other things.
Yeah,
anyway,
no.
Yeah, what are we colonials doing? Anyway, he was extremely popular. And then one day we got a letter, a very official-looking letter with a London postmark on it, from Private Eye magazine in London. And it was from the lawyer for Private Eye magazine. And they informed us that they were going to sue Basic Black because a George St. John Quimby had been stealing stories from Private Eye and putting them on air. And it turned out that he had, in fact, Private Eye was Britain's Frank magazine. Actually, Private Eye precedes Frank magazine, but it was a sort of a scatological, saucy kind of magazine. It was about politics. And unlike most of us who take stories from all kinds of places and change four words and call it research, he was doing it word for word. So they had us cold. So George's employment was severed shortly after that.
There was a time then he wasn't on, right?
Oh, yeah.
In the last stretch.
The last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's still the most common question. Oh, that George. A lot of people thought it was me. They were sure it was me putting on the accent, but it wasn't. That wasn't his real name either. He was a reporter in London.
So that's too bad, eh? That must have been a little bit of a sour note.
Well, yeah.
Because you trusted him.
I think we probably trusted him too much.
Yeah.
George, we knew he was a little flaky. You know?
Yeah, a little off the wall.
Yeah. But that's why we hired him.
Well, yeah.
It just didn't occur to us that he would do that, but he did.
Yeah, be so obvious and think that...
Yeah, because he could have just changed two sentences and, you know, or even, see, as far as we're concerned, he could have said, you know, as reported in Private Eye magazine, that would have been fine.
That's all it would have taken, eh?
Absolutely, yeah. As long as it's attributed, you know, as long as it's attributed and honestly.
Is there anything you want to talk about that we haven't talked about? Like when you were a door-to-door encyclopedia salesman?
That wouldn't take long. I lasted one evening, exactly.
Really?
It was terrible. It was
worth mentioning, though. Nice to have on the resume for fun.
I guess so, yeah. I spent longer learning to be an encyclopedia salesman than there was an ad in the paper. I was broken out of work. And it said, earn $120 a week. And that was a fabulous salary. You can tell you how long ago that was. But $120 a week. So I went and thought, yeah, sure enough, you're selling encyclopedias. And they give you spend an entire day in this classroom learning the speech. There's an abstract speech. You're told, this has been devised by psychologists, so don't deviate. And there's, in fact, one point where you ask for a glass. You say, all this talk is making me thirsty. Ma'am, can you get me a glass of water?
Oh, no.
And the little housewife goes out and gets a glass of water. And you concentrate on the husband or vice versa, whoever makes the move. It was hideous.
Yeah.
It was awful. Anyway, I spent one night doing that. I didn't even do it by myself at all. I went with one other guy as an apprentice just to learn how it was done. And I watched him sell a set of encyclopedia to a family that really couldn't afford it, and a bookcase to keep it in, which they also couldn't afford.
Yeah,
and I
was just,
it was this far from stealing. You know, I'd rather rob banks and sell encyclopedias that way.
Yeah.
It was awful. That was my
career. Well, it's good to know what you do want to do or what you feel comfortable doing to have a bit of contrast.
Yeah.
Now, these photos of you on the front of your books, who's your photographer?
There's a fellow on the island named Howard Fry. He's taken the last 3 or 4 books here on the island. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
He's a very good photographer, and he's kind enough to do them for me. So.
Yeah, well, he's certainly portrayed you well.
Good.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's the only reason I knew what you looked like, was I've never seen you on the TV. So if you hadn't done everything that you've done in this life so far, do you have any idea what a parallel track would have been?
Sometimes I think I might have moved to California, and I don't know why. I think it probably would have been, or New York. just to do it, just to see what it's like, just to see, because it's totally foreign to my nature. It's exactly what I think I don't want to do, but I always think it would be interesting to find out if that's true. New York even more than California. New York,
yeah.
Just because it's everything I'm not. And I'd like to see what would happen. Like, I suspect I would probably come home after about 6 months, you know, like, and I hope it would be fine with me too, but I would like to have tried it. I would like to have seen.
Because you're not that kind of guy?
I don't think I am. No, I'm not. No, I don't believe I am.
But you're more of a country guy?
I'm really a country guy.
And a Canadian guy.
Yeah.
Really Canadian. You really make a point of being Canadian?
Yeah. Somebody said to me, why don't you get your books published in the States? And I said, because they wouldn't understand them. It's all about, it's all Canadian references. That's because that's who I am. Somebody said, well, you could write it. You know, you don't have to write about Northwestern Ontario or Southwestern BC. You could change that. Yeah, but what's the point?
No, it's a really good point. Yeah, you do have a very strong Canadian focus. That is what you know, like you say. So you couldn't go there and fake it unless you went and lived there for half your life.
Yeah.
Then
you
would be able to write from that perspective.
Yeah. Although I'm saying it, but it's more like I'm saying, like, I'd like to go and sail on a tramp steamer through the, you know, the Malay Straits and see if pirates attack. I mean, it's that kind of silly wish thing. Like, you're thinking, like, I just want to do something that's totally different. Not that I want to spend my life doing it, but I would like to try. I'd like to see it. Just taste it. I'm quite happy with the way my writing's turned out and with the subjects that I've chosen to write about and the places I've chosen to write about. It's I love this place, you know?
Yeah, that's obvious. I mean, you wouldn't write with such passion about all these different subjects if you didn't feel strongly and love it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's a great country. I mean, I love it when I see other countries' take on us. And, like, the English can be very dismissive about Canada, as can the Americans. But it's basic because they don't have a clue. They don't have any idea what this country's about or how vast and how intricate it is, how many amazing things there are about this country.
Well, there's this great piece that you wrote about how it's easy to identify people from other countries. Like, you say France or Spain and immediately. But when you say Canada, it's like, well, you know, what exactly is a Canadian,
exactly,
right? And it's true. I mean, it isn't easy to define a Canadian.
No. It's really interesting. I mean, I think I can spot them by their demeanor. They tend to be politer than most. They tend to be quieter than most, but not always. I mean, you say that, then you think of a Normandy beach or a hockey arena on Saturday night. You know, it's a country of contradictions.
And defensive, too, right? Like, if you go up to somebody in the bar, you know that piece that you wrote about saying, so what part of America are you from, right? And the guy says, no, I'm Canadian.
That's right. And they launch into the lecture,
right.
Yeah, I think we're getting over that. I saw a movie the other night. I was really happy. It's a movie called Across the Universe. And at one point, there's a character in the movie who's facing the draft in the States. It's in the 60s. And he's oh God, am I one of my choices? I can be drafted or I can go to Canada, the vast wasteland. And instead of everybody going, everybody laughed in the theater. I thought, that's great. That's great. You know, they're finally at ease enough to say, you know, yeah, that's what people think. So what? You know, sometimes it's better if people don't know too much about us because then they don't come here.
Just the contrast between the two as far as how people respond to you. 1991. Yeah. Wow. That's a while ago now. I drove across Canada. And part of the way I went through the States, partly because I ran out of money a few times and I had to keep selling photographs to keep going, and the gas was a lot cheaper, fortunately. I guess it was on my way back. I came through the States quite a ways on my way back, and I had my car all set up to sleep in, and so I'd stop at trucking stops, you know, and go into the restaurant. What I so noticed was that in the States, nobody looked at me. I didn't feel like there was a spotlight on me as I walked in and out. I felt quite safe. Yeah. And yet when I came into Canada, across the border, and I went to, you know, one of these truck stops, and everybody stared at me.
Yeah, it's true. I remember the
weird.
I had this experience in Viking, Alberta, of all places. Viking is one of those places that the Trans-Canada just missed, you know, like it goes by about 2 miles outside, and that was the end of Viking, right? As a thriving place. It's still there, and there's still farmers, and they still go to the cafe. You see these guys with these great red hands around a coffee cup. And I remember I walked in to get a cup of coffee, and I felt like I was Cher. I mean, like, it was just incredible. Like everybody was just, what's your story, stranger? That's what their eyes were saying. You know, I mean, they're Canadians, so they didn't say anything. But,
no,
but they were absolutely devouring him. That's a Canadian thing, too. Yeah, it's funny. Of course, there's Canada in Canada. When I go to Toronto, it feels a lot more like America than most places. I remember the last time I was in Toronto, I was in the airport, and I was walking along.
Doing my thing.
Going to my luggage carousel or whatever.
Yeah.
And I heard a guy behind me cursing. And I looked around, and he was cursing because I wasn't walking fast enough. He was in a hurry.
And there wasn't any passing lane or anything?
Well, I guess not. I guess it was traffic coming both ways. Yeah. But I thought, holy smoke, how much of a hurry can you be? It wasn't like he was running. It wasn't like he was trying to catch a flight. It was just that I wasn't doing the minimum speed. Yeah,
that's pretty bold for a Canadian, though. I mean, people do that when you're driving, right? But they don't necessarily make it known that they're frustrated in person.
That's true. Well, maybe I'm doing a disservice. Maybe it was a guy from Buffalo. Who knows?
Any vision for the future from here on in? You're just going to keep doing what you're doing? Any ambitions?
Well, I'm toying with the idea of doing something we talked about already, which is sort of exploring the computer, like to see the kind of stuff I can do. Like I've been trying to do an audiobook for years, not trying. I've been toying with the idea of doing an audiobook for years because I like to read my stuff. It seems like a natural thing to do. But I haven't pursued it actively enough to make it happen, but that's one thing I'd like to do.
Mm-hmm.
I suddenly realized that I can actually voice stuff on my computer. This is all new to me. I've been ignoring... I still think of a podcast as something that involves orcas. You know, I don't even know what it is.
You obviously live on the coast. Well, you have such a great voice, Arthur, and I think that would be wonderful for you to be able to share it.
It would be fun. Yeah. I would like to do it.
So, yeah, so just to keep that current.
I think, and you know what? I'm going to update my website.
Right. Yeah, I'll look for that. Well, Arthur Black, it's been great talking to you. Now, I just wonder if your mind has calculated at all anything about living on purpose, what that might mean for you.
My first thought is that I don't live on purpose. I live at random, and somehow that works out for me. I don't know. Maybe I would have been better off to live with a purpose. But I sort of wake up every day and say, oh, geez, what happens today? Maybe that's a kind of purpose in its own, you know, in a backhanded kind of way.
Yeah, it is very open to interpretation not to force everybody to have a purpose, however they approach things. I mean, not to say, oh, you have a purpose and this is what it is. It's like if you wake up in the morning and you're open to the possibilities, then, yeah, I think that in itself, that's your purpose, right?
Yeah. People putting their lives on track because tracks become ruts.
Yeah.
And I'm nervous about that. So. But yeah, I kind of like just throwing the dice and seeing what comes up.
Yeah. Well, and you're right. We sort of lean towards the familiar. Like, it's hard to see something completely new.
Yeah, that's very true.
Because we're always orienting it to things that have come before, right?
Yeah. And you get more timid as you get older, unfortunately. You know that if you fall down real hard, you might break something this time.
You're not as close to the ground as you were when you were little, right?
That too.
I think when we see little kids fall, we're cringing because we're imagining ourselves at this height
falling.
Yeah,
exactly. You know how much that would hurt, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And they're made of rubber, too. You know, we're not.
Well, yeah. They're still really springy.
Yeah.
Well, Arthur Black, it's been such a pleasure talking with you.
It's been a lot of fun talking with you. And it's nice not to do it in a fusty old radio studio, too.
Yeah, I love the view. That works for me.
Thanks, Lynn.
All right, take care.
My name's Arthur Black, and you're listening to Living on Purpose with Lynn Thompson.